The Tom Woods Show, episode 647.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy this show, you're really going to like the free course I've made available to you on the real history of the U.S. presidents. Very, very helpful, especially during an election year. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We have today an episode on a topic that, well, isn't exactly what you'd expect from this podcast, but it touches on cancer, health, doctors, insurance, the FDA, and frankly, it's just a human interest story as well. And it involves my friend Roger McCaffrey, who's been a guest on the show a couple times before. And I've had people write to me and say, Roger McCaffrey is my favorite guest on your show. Now, of course, today's episode is much more serious. And so the tone will be much different in this episode. We're talking about Roger's son, John, who was diagnosed with CML, which is a kind of stem cell cancer, and died at age 8. And we're going to talk about Roger's experiences through this ordeal that lasted several years. And there may be something in it that you can take away, particularly if you are struggling with cancer or you know somebody who is, or you're just interested in how somebody navigates the healthcare industry. Very, very interesting. Roger, we talked to in the past about, Roger's an expert on the Catholic Church, but we also talked to him about politics. He worked for Pat Buchanan in 1992. He's done a lot of direct mail work. He's an expert at that. He's written books that are of general interest. I'm linking to at tomwoods.com/647. He's been published in a wide array of periodicals, and I'm going to welcome him to the show right now. Roger, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here, as always.
Hard to know really where to begin with this story. I suppose we should begin with, and you know, I know the basic story because you and I were friends at the time, and I was working for your magazines at the time. So I know basically what happened, but I don't know a lot of the details. So you got a diagnosis for your, was he at that time 8 years old, son? How old was he?
John was 4 and a half at that point.
Okay, so he was very, very young at the beginning. Okay. So this was quite a struggle.
Yeah, and he had, you know, we had three other children. So we had ages 2, 4, 6, and 8. This came out of nowhere, as John said to one reporter, because even John was interviewed at the time, eventually was interviewed. One day I felt fine, and the next day I woke up and I had pain in my legs. Well, that was the leukemia, which is really a misnomer for his disease. He had stem cell cancer. It's a form of leukemia, but every leukemia is as different from another leukemia as pancreatic cancer is from lung cancer. So he had a stem cell cancer, and it was always fatal. It took 5 years. It was chronic rather than acute. So it took about, on average, 5 years to kill its victims. And they were almost always adults. I mean, there were 50 children a year under the age of 16 who got this cancer. So, I mean, it was utterly rare. I mean, all childhood cancer is rare. But this is almost unheard of. I mean, there probably were 10 other children under the age of 6 who had this disease.
So that, you get that news, and of course your mind races in a million directions, but you think, well, look, I'll do whatever they tell me to do. Is that what it was like?
Yeah, exactly what it was like for the first 10 months. We did, there were two options. One, you treat him with conventional chemo and interferon, which is not exactly, it's a meta chemo. It's not really a chemo. It revs up your immune system. It's a hormone of some sort, I guess. Or you do a stem cell transplant, also known as a bone marrow transplant. So we opted for the latter because it was, as they say in the profession, curative, C-U-R-A-T-I-V-E, which is one of their terms. And so, yeah, we did that. We did a bone marrow transplant. The 10 months were filled with much pain and anxiety for John, more anxiety for us, but much pain for John. And so that was phase one. There were three stages to the cancer, but there's also three elements to this story. It went on for 3.5 years. So in any event, we did what we were told, and we treated him at, two major places in Connecticut. We'll leave it at that and for now. And that was a total failure in the end. Then we discovered an experimental drug, but that's a story in itself, and I'd like to save it for 5 or 10 minutes down the road, because we pursued it against all odds and got it. That was a miracle in itself. But so we did what we were told. The protocol that was applied to John was two different kinds of chemo, to oversimplify it, and a lot of bed rest. I mean, the protocol was, ancient, of course. Protocols tend to be ancient. That's why they're protocols. So that nearly killed him. You'll be shocked to hear, Tom.
Okay, so at some point, the parents in these situations presumably assert themselves against the doctor. Is that something that happened here?
Fair enough. That's what happened. But it took us 10 months to get up to speed, both on the disease, on the so-called treatment options, and thirdly, on the fact that, like all professions, you have average docs, whether they're hematologists or not, and very below average, you have lots of deception, you have honest people. So that ran the gamut, because we dealt in that first 10 months with four major hematologists, pediatric people, regularly, and I mean more than anyone will ever deal with most, with doctors. So, and then we saw four or five others as well in the transplant unit where John was for 7 weeks. It's a sterile unit, so you can imagine what that was like. Once we figured out that the bone marrow transplant, aka stem cell transplant, because that's what it really was, failed, we expressed our, let's say, disappointment, because we were actually deceived. They knew it had failed undoubtedly 4 months before that was confirmed. And you lose 4 months with a cancer. The cancer tends to grow, not shrink. So we lost a lot of time being obedient servants, to the docs, who really didn't spend a hell of a lot of time worrying about John. Let's face it. I mean, they have other patients. They have families themselves. You, the patient, especially the parent of a pediatric patient, have to do your homework and be on high alert. That's the first thing we learned. But the second thing we learned is that we needed to find other institutions that might be better than the ones that we had.
All right, before we go there, why would they keep something like that from you for that length of time?
Well, who wants to tell the parents of a beautiful little boy that they botched it? And, of course, there was a chance this would fail. We all knew that. But there was a particular reason that we felt that they botched it, which had to do with the quantity of stem cells that were actually infused into John after they blew out his own bone marrow, which is part of the protocol. You blow out completely the bone marrow in order to replace it with new stem cells, which become bone marrow and, they're blood stem cells. So they become what you want them to be if everything works out. They botched the job. And so they didn't want to tell us. I mean, they never tested for engraftment. We got the chart, which was huge. The chart being the documentation of treatment. we got that. We had the complete chart. I still have it, of course. And it showed no test for engraftment of the new stem cells, which means either they tested and threw out the results because they were disappointing, or they didn't bother to test. I mean, it's that dramatic, that shocking.
Well, is this the sort of thing that if you hadn't had, you know, a life-threatening emergency on your hands, you might have had legal recourse?
Yeah, you know, of course. But when you're dealing with a dying, unofficially dying boy,
right? That, of course. You know,
that, but yes, certainly there's always that in American medicine. For heaven's sake, you can sue for a hangnail, and these days, especially with this new crop of federal judges, they were no great shakes 20 years ago. Today, man, you know, yeah, sure, there was legal recourse, which has not been taken.
All right, so then you start looking elsewhere. Where are you looking?
Well, we got the news in December of 1998, and so, of course, immediately I started looking at the best bone marrow transplant places, because in the cancer business, the cancer industry, you just do over again what just failed. I mean, the concepts are almost laughable, you know. So everybody wanted to try another transplant, which, had, as we say, just failed. And we were skeptical, but I figured we might have to do this. So I went to Dana-Farber, which is a bone marrow transplant, one of the better cancer centers in America. I went to Sloan Kettering. I went to the Fred Hutchinson Institute. All of this with John. I took care of John day to day a lot of the time because Priscilla had the children, the other children. So. And I went to, I talked to Mayo Clinic. I talked probably, I forget, I got to look at my notes, probably the Johns Hopkins, bone marrow transplant unit. But anyway, we went everywhere we could, and I took John everywhere so that I could get the very best, second opinions. And I got about 5 second opinions. All of this, by the way, while fighting off the insurance company, which told me I had to stay in network. We were in an HMO at the time. These days, by the way, almost every insurance plan in effect because of the Obama health takeover is an HMO. So back then you could, and even 5 years ago, you if you had the right plan, you really could, you had great flexibility. But now you really don't have the flexibility that you think you might have. You're stuck in networks that are increasingly shrinking. They're not really growing most of the time. So, okay, so we started looking at better places, let's put it that way, to do a bone marrow transplant, but hating the whole idea because the bone marrow transplant involves blowing out functioning bone marrow, all of it, so that your white blood cell count in this disease goes to zero. Zero. So you have no ability to fight infection.
Oh my gosh.
That's what a bone marrow transplant typically, to oversimplify it, that's what it typically is, certainly in this disease. So, you know, okay, at the same time I have been reading for months all kinds of medical journal articles that I have friends with Xerox at the Yale Medical School library, and so I still have everything. I got 8 boxes of files. 1,000 emails and letters and memos and notes of different phone conversations. I still have everything. But I stumbled on because a friend of mine who's a journalist saw this tiny little UPI or AP item about a new drug used on mice, lab mice, with CML, which was John's disease. CML is a stem cell cancer that has one genetic defect only. Every other cancer has multiple genetic defects. CML has one, called the Philadelphia chromosome. It's a chromosomal defect. In mice in Italy, this drug, which was CGP-57148B, cured 100% of the mice. So this I found out in January of 99. So, you know, almost miraculously, at least in my mind, there was an alternative to stem cell transplant. So But it was only in mice. So I picked up the phone as soon as I read the article, and I called the doctor in Italy, who has since become a good friend, Dr. Carlo Gambacorti, who's a clinical oncologist and hematologist, and he's also now a world-renowned in his field, a world-renowned blood cancer expert. And he said, how do I get this for John? I don't care about the mice bit. How do I get this for John? Well, I mean, this was an unusual phone call because most people don't do this.
Right.
And he said, they're using it in humans in one place. And that was in Oregon at the Oregon Health Science University. And he said, you should call Dr. Brian Druker. Druker was the chief investigator, now the most famous oncologist, I would say probably in the world. Then, another scientist seeking a cure. But he knew he had something, and he knew it for years. So I called Druker, to my shock, first of all, I got through to him. I was accustomed to being elbowed in the face by your standard issue Northeastern American oncologist. You know, we spent months getting elbowed and misled. Druker, by contrast, answered the phone and we spoke. And I said to him, gave him John's situation. And Druker was not a pediatric guy. But I said, look, I'd like to come out and talk to you. And I flew out with John using a corporate angel network.
Stop and say something about that. I really, really liked, I didn't know about that until you used it.
Yeah, they fly many hundreds, maybe even into the early thousands of cancer patients per year on empty seats given, donated by corporations. Almost always it's a corporation. No, I don't think there are too many rock stars sharing their empty seats on their private jets. I only dealt with business, and then when John and I flew, it turned out dozens of times on these corporate jets, because Druker eventually took John as a patient, his first pediatric patient. But corporate angel, the nonprofit, which is headquartered in White Plains, finds you empty seats on willing corporate jets. And so we flew a lot of time with the CEOs or number two guys in companies, and a lot of times the jets were empty. They were being positioned for flights the next day or whatever. But this charity done by these corporations gets them absolutely zero in tax credits or write-offs. This is pure generosity. You know, and they never get credit for this. Only the Wall Street Journal has given them any real credit in nationally speaking. Only the Journal.
But it saved you and many other similar parents a fortune.
Not only does it save people a fortune, but you can't fly commercially if your son has a severely immunocompromised system.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's the really obvious thing.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, that's fundamental. And plus, it was a total hassle to fly, which we occasionally did. But I mean, it was almost a nightmare to fly with John for that reason alone, on commercial, airliners. But anyway, the corporations, there's at least a couple of hundred corporations, large and small, who share their empty seats. At least there might be by now. Corporate Angel Network might have 500 or 600 of these. They never get credit for this. They just get bashed by everybody from the Pope, on over to his friends in the Obama administration and in the Ivy League institutions that dominate dominate academic life. So, but the generosity of these people would never cease to amaze me. And a couple of times they would divert their planes to pick up John. I mean, it was just very touching to see.
Wow. Yeah, that's nice.
And I might add that in terms of cancer medicine, Corporate Angel Network cooperators, these companies, actually supply a large number of clinical trial patients, as John was eventually. because they did put him on the drug, although I'm getting ahead of myself in the story. He was the first child to use this drug. And only because of corporate angel network and these generous companies were we able to do that. But the same was true for many, many patients. In this clinical trial for this Drucker drug and many other lesser drugs, but still better drugs. So, you know, that's a dividend that nobody ever talks about, except the Wall Street Journal about every, 8 years when I happen to write an article. I wrote two op-ed pieces for them over a 7 or 8 year period. So, we got that point across,
All right. So you get out to Oregon. You talk to Dr. Drucker.
Yeah. Drucker is now, he's won the Lasker Prize for medicine. He's won the Japan Prize. This puts him on a track for a potential Nobel Prize. So that's how far he's come, and he's now heading up a $1 billion cancer research facility at Oregon Health Science University. But we got to just to know him as Brian Drucker. This was pre-famous Brian, but I still keep in touch with him because I found him both heroic on our behalf. And also, I was very impressed by the way he dealt with my son. And he bought John just by fiat, just out of the goodness of his heart. He really gave us, 2.5 more years with John. And every day is precious, especially in hindsight. That's about as personal as I can get because this all feels like it happened yesterday, Tom.
Yeah, I understand that. Sure.
So I'm going to be sounding a little clinical about the case because I have to some degree separate myself. But it's all been bottled up in me because aside from the two journal articles, I haven't really talked to anyone about it. You're one of the very few. And it's all still very fresh to me, and I'd like to help other folks who are going through something similar. That goes without saying, but none of my friends ask me about it, and most people kind of assume you don't want to talk about it. After all, and it's not a bad it's quite rational to think that way. But in this case, what we did was so unusual and so great for John that you're damn right I want to talk about it. And I want other people to know several things about dealing with cancer, either if they're dealing with it themselves or their parents are dealing with it, or God forbid their children are. Yeah. So I'm writing a book, which is a good year away, but anyhow, Drucker's a big deal. He was a big deal in John's life, because of his example and his guts, because he put his career on the line, I assure you, by taking a child as a patient, with the FDA looking down his throat. The FDA always does. In fact, one I won't say who the doctor was, but somebody well known said to me, if John dies when he's on this drug, which became Gleevec, by the way, it's a very well-known drug now. If John dies when he's on this drug, they're going to shut the whole program down. I mean, that by the way, which would be a death sentence for the first 30 or 40 patients who were on the drug. Because at the time John got the drug, there were only 30. Well, when I spoke to Drucker that first time and took John out to meet him, that there were only 31 patients on this drug, all adults, all dead meat. If they didn't have this drug, they had failed all the protocol drugs. They were dying. Every one of them, had his life turned around almost immediately, as did John. So what we did was, we defied, the very, very best pediatric and other oncology docs in the country by refusing to do a second stem cell transplant. And Priscilla, my wife, was, of course, directly involved in influencing that. But We just basically told them, you know, we're not going to do this, you know. And I said to one, and I went to, eventually I got John in New York into what one physician refers to as super duper cancer center. And they were, you know, they were super duper, and they have a super duper PR department too, I might add, but they were the very best. And the hematologist said, well, we got to do a second transplant. And I said, well, you know, you're so big on this, what are his chances? She said 20%. And I knew what that meant. You know, Tom, here's a little hint for your listeners. 20% in that circumstance, that really means 10%.
Yeah.
And the suffering that would be engendered in John was unthinkable. I mean, the suffering of, we saw people in the bone marrow unit, you know, dying, and, you know, people would just turn black. Their organs, when you transplant bone marrow or stem cells, they attack. They see your body as an alien, and they attack. Typically, they attack your body. They attack the vital organs, and you need anti-rejection drugs for the rest of your life, usually, to deal with that, you know, attack. Now, one of the benefits is that those attacking cells from the donor also kill off the leukemia that's in your son. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that they were juggling. But you see the mad scientist approach here, don't you?
Did Drucker back you in this decision?
Yeah, but we had to make it clear to Brian that, we're two fairly intelligent people, and I do write, as you know.
Yeah.
So I made it abundantly clear to all concerned that we rejected the option of a second bone marrow transplant. In science, after all, when a concept fails, why the hell do you repeat it? I mean, you know, it's just not logical to roll the dice like that. And mind you, though, we had not completely foreclosed on the option of doing a second transplant. But we argued that since John's leukemia, like everything else, was killed by the transplant process, we had some time. We knew we didn't have a lot of time, but we figured we had some time. And but once we discovered the Drucker drug, and I went out to meet with Drucker, with John, and we saw that the thing was really working. We were adamant. By then we were adamant. But you still need a physician with courage to back you. And we did find them, and Drucker led the way. But by his example, there were two or three others who to a lesser extent, put themselves on the line for John. Again, because in America, you can sue the minute your son dies. You can file a lawsuit no matter what you promise these people. And we did promise them that we would not hold it against them. And although in the courts, our word meant nothing, as you know, to us, it meant everything. So Brian, God bless him. He saw that we meant what we said. We put it in writing. He believed us. In the end, you have to be human. And he took our word. But by taking our word, he risked a lot.
Yeah.
So then I got someone on the East Coast to follow John when we were home, because John and I commuted to Portland, Oregon, but, you know, we still lived on the East Coast. So we got somebody who's no longer there at Westchester Medical Center who stuck his neck out for us, and he followed John while we were here. My larger point is you can find men of courage, and there were, of course, the nurses tended to be women, and thank God for that, because they made life bearable every step of the way. And in oncology, in pediatric oncology, the nurses are everything. So, any case, and needless to say, there were a couple of female hemoncs who helped us out as well. But most of these guys were men, and most of them showed a lack of courage. But we really appreciated it when we met those who put their careers on the line. And I can't say it enough. That's exactly what they did in that early stage. That's exactly what they did. But you got to find those people, and you got to research. If you have cancer or a loved one has cancer, you have to research. You've got to read. You've got to. It's easy now. It was harder then, because this was the web was going, but it wasn't as fertile as it is now. Now you can research almost anything on the web. Then I had to do a combination of library and web stuff. But anyway, we took Brian. Now there's one thing I haven't said, which is that once the transplant failed and that was documented, I called. You know, I have a couple of friends in Washington, and I'm not ashamed of that, quite. But I called them. I called every friend I had down there, and I was down there for 3 years. And you know, our family tentacles go back two generations in politics, conservative politics. But I got a couple of folks to help me who would not be accused of, conservatism like Dick Gephardt. And these guys, what they did was they wrote letters. Nothing was public, and I knew they couldn't convince anyone scientifically. I just wanted them to attest to our sincerity. And so, no, I wasn't a big political wheel asking for anything more than just, you know, contact the drug company. They didn't have to do Drucker. They had to contact the drug company and tell them we're sincere when we say we're not going to sue anybody. We're not going to blame anybody if this doesn't work. But, you know, in effect, I know the McCaffreys and they mean what they say. And couldn't you bend your protocol?
Right. Okay.
So I did get that. I did have that help, and that I mentioned in the Wall Street Journal article of October 2009. But that wasn't by any means the reason that Drucker did this. When I first met Drucker with John, he didn't know any of this. You know, it was only after that, after he said to me, "I think I can help John," that I said to him, "Well, I think I can help you." And I said, I have former President Bush had made a phone call, not about this drug, but to help us get a second opinion in December. So I was able to tell Brian Drucker that Bush was, at least in theory, at least aware of our case. But it was Gephardt and Gingrich and Senator Connie Mack and Congressman Bob Schaefer of Colorado. These are the four who contacted the drug company Novartis and told them, you know, McCaffrey, you can trust McCaffrey, in essence. I don't know how much you want me to talk about the political aspect of this, but of course, cynics are going to say, well, you know, McCaffrey had money and McCaffrey had connections. Hell, the hell I had connections. I mean, yeah, of course, I work down there, so I know people, but.
Well, and plus you're asking for something that if the crazy government courts weren't so crazy, you wouldn't even have to ask for. I mean, you would be able to have your word count for something.
Exactly. Imagine you sign a document and that's the one thing that's useless in a case.
Yeah.
Only in America, man. You know,
yeah.
No other country would invent that kind of dipsy-doodle.
Yeah, the one thing we're not interested in is your written statement on the subject at the time.
Right.
What else you got?
Right. It's just, but you know, this was a major stumbling block in the lives not only of John, but you know, a lot of people, and still is, because it makes drug companies double talk you whenever you want a good new drug, and there are many good new drugs out there. Nothing like Gleevec, the Drucker drug. Nothing. There isn't a cancer drug like this. It's totally unique, and it remains unique in that it essentially eradicates, on all but a molecular level, the cancer that killed everybody and that ultimately killed my son. And I mean, you know, and many patients are totally molecularly cancer free on this drug. In any event, we used some friends to write letters, but I didn't know they were going to write these. You know, I knew Bush made a call for us in Texas. Thank God. God bless him for that. You know, and politicians, no matter what you think of them, when there's a child's life on the line, they they showed me a lot, because all but one that I contacted came through for us with flying colors.
Now, this is H.W. Bush you're talking about.
H.W., yeah. This was Bush the First, as we call him, George the First.
Yeah.
And by the way, not a dime. Needless to say, not a dime change. That's just unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable. And in fact, in the one case where somebody didn't come through for me, I went down there always with John. I took him to Washington. And I look back on those trips with great affection, by the way. There's so many people down there on the staffs, and you know a couple yourself.
Yeah.
On the staffs of these guys who bent over backwards. But there was one guy, I won't use his name because but he was a major figure in the Republican Party at the time, and I had dinner with his press secretary, I guess, and I said to him, Gephardt's in our corner, and Gephardt's really extending himself for John. And I said, would your guy be willing to do something for us? The reason I did this, Tom, is because it turned out in my mind that one heavy hitter wasn't enough. That shows you the power of the FDA in my book, but even a Gephardt by himself couldn't persuade them to let John try the drug. Let this dying boy try the drug.
Yeah, yeah.
Gephardt not only called the CEO, he wrote to him, and then and so forth and so on. So I said to this press secretary for a major Republican power broker, I mean, top guy, he said, well, you know, he'll do it if you can get a joint press conference with Gephardt. I mean, you know, and that was the only cynicism that injected itself with regard to John's case among these politicians that I dealt with. I was flabbergasted. And of course, I said, well, first of all, we're not going public. But this is a situation where I don't want anything said publicly. I just want the drug for John.
Yeah, right.
Would have been a colossal mistake to go public and try to embarrass people and so forth. So anyway, that's a whole chapter in my book, but it does illustrate how powerful the FDA was. So we got the drug, and again, Drucker committed to this privately, and that was all I needed. But before he knew any of this could happen, and I told him I didn't know it could happen. I told him ahead of time that I would ask for some help. And I told him by illustration that Bush had helped us privately. But he didn't know any of this, and he was willing to do it even so. And I contend that the guy who gave him half his $1 billion for his institute probably read the Wall Street Journal piece that I did, and I contend that that would have helped, because I can testify to the character of Drucker. You know, I knew him when nobody knew him.
Well, now I want to know, so John gets the drug and you say that the effects are almost immediate. Well, what do you quantify that? What's almost immediate?
Normal blood counts. Now, it took us 4 months to get him on the drug, 4 to 5 months. But, you know, Novartis, the drug company, assented after about 8 weeks. At least in theory, they said, well, we're willing to do it. Okay, so once he got the drug, by the way, it was a pill. Here we had been giving him shots and all kinds of horrible. I mean, I was giving him shots personally because that's what the insurance company insisted upon as a condition for covering John. You know, they said to me, "You're going to have to do that. You're going to have to inject him with his chemo." Alternatively, I could have driven 3 times a week to the hematologist office, which was an hour and a half away, basically an hour and a half away. So I've been giving him, I gave him hundreds of shots over the course of his life, and most of them in that first year, okay? And these were not tiny little flu shots. These burning injections.
Oh, horrible, horrible.
You know, I mean, it was horrible. It was horrible. It was horrible.
Oh,
and this was, but this, Tom, this was the protocol. This was the protocol that they all, except a couple, wanted to try all over again. So you can imagine, I haven't portrayed the sheer horror of that first year. But okay, so we're, you know, we were injecting him with two forms of chemo and occasionally, more than occasionally, very occasionally, Epogen, which is a red blood cell stimulating hormone, and Neupogen, which is a white blood cell stimulating hormone. All of these are subcutaneous injections, usually in the leg. And in place of that, the Drucker drug was two pills, and it eradicated in John's peripheral blood the leukemia that was going to kill him and was going to kill him, you know, within a year or two. So the reason it eradicated it is because it was a protein inhibitor. It's an enzyme inhibitor. It kills the errant stem cell, which is the Philadelphia chromosome defect that I mentioned earlier. It inhibits the protein that feeds that cancer cell. And because it's a stem cell cancer and there's only one defect, it just wiped it out. Within 2 weeks, on two pills a day, his blood counts had totally normalized. And then we did a bone marrow biopsy where they drill the hip, anesthetizing the patient, the boy. You know, they drill the hip and pull out a sample. And on the molecular level, it was as his pediatric guy told me, he looked at the slide and he came out and pulled me into the lab and said, "Look at this. This is totally normal bone marrow. If I didn't know he had CML, I would just tell you to go home."
That's insane.
And so that was, but we sort of knew this would happen. I mean, by then Drucker knew it would happen. He all but knew that would happen.
Yeah, but until that moment that you get those words, you know,
It was stunning. It was stunning, and at the same time, we were constantly on our guard, both because we had to do hand-to-hand combat with Novartis, which is a Swiss pharmaceutical. And, you know, until they gave us the drug, we didn't really know we'd get it. And we saw that even with heavy hitting solid names down in Washington, they were reluctant to, you know, to do it. So that whole year, that's the second part of this three-part story. That whole year when John was on that drug was heaven sent, I'll tell you.
Now, how did it come about that 2020 found out about this? I remember watching you, seeing you on 2020 talking about, and I saw John on TV, the whole thing.
Yeah. I still have that, of course. I'm going to pop it in and play it one of these days. But Tim Johnson, Dr. Tim Johnson, who did their medical reporting and all of ABC's medical reporting. I mean, he was a pathologist. So the pathology in cancer now, pathology reports are everything. He probably read about Gleevec around the time we did, when it was back when it was CGP57148B. And he called Drucker and followed the progress, because alone among medical reporters of national note, Tim Johnson knew what this meant. So eventually, Dr. Drucker saw this was working in John, and when they asked, you know, "Do you have anyone young?" And he referred Tim Johnson to us, and then they did the big story. But there's so much to this that I have to put into a book, because I can't talk about it easily, or there's so much detail. But one of the dramatic elements to this was that John got pneumonia in right after the 2020 episode ran. So his blood counts, for whatever reason, I mean, he had weak bone marrow forever because of the transplant that failed, but he dropped so low in his white blood cell count that is to say, the Gleevec drug was killing all his white blood cells, because most of them molecularly had this genetic defect. So they took him off the drug because that's what Novartis required. Drucker you know, did not control the drug. He controlled limited supplies of the drug. Novartis owned the drug, not Brian Druge. They took us off. And, you know, then John recovered and we went back on. But that 4 to 6 week period ultimately was his downfall, because once he got off the drug, the cancer, you know, gathered steam. And then 3 months after that, he began to accelerate. So that's the real tragedy. That and again, the drug companies worried primarily about. I mean, they're worried that they could easily argue they were worried about killing the patient. The patient was dying anyway, Tom.
Yeah.
You know, officially, John was terminal with the failed bone marrow transplant. But they were also, Novartis was also worried about the FDA, and you know that. That really, I mean, everything you hear about the FDA in a way is true. There's more to it than that sometimes, because, of course, you know, they're scientists too, and they have something to say that's useful. But, of course, they're just this colossus, this centralized colossus that has everybody spooked permanently. But, secondly, lawyers have everybody spooked.
Yeah, sure.
Let's face it, even without the FDA, and for better or worse, lawyers would be enough of a force nationally, collectively, to scare a lot of drug companies. The engineering the quiet campaign to get John this drug, that's the greatest thing I've ever done, period.
Yeah.
And I didn't use the press at all. And nobody knows this, you know. Nobody wants to talk about it. I don't even think my family yet knows the details of this. Some of them do, sort of, you know.
Yeah, that's because, of course, that there would have been a temptation if you wanted to, you know, to carry on some campaign to get this drug, to go to the press, to make a lot of noise, to get a petition, to get some signatures. And that's it turns out that's actually the very last thing you want to do.
The very last thing. And I knew that much, you know. I mean, my instincts are not bad. By contrast, a couple of years later, when we needed a second drug because John John was really deteriorating, I did go to the press, but that was because I had to do something quick. And it took, I mean, I was doing battle with a second drug company. I call it battle because that's what it felt like. For 4 months, and I wasn't really getting anywhere. So I had four new guys from Washington helping on that one. We were getting somewhere, but it wasn't quick enough. So finally, I wrote a piece for the Washington Times, and you know, I immediately got action after that. But we had prepared the groundwork. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We're with Druker in the great year, and. And by the way, Druker he followed John, but he wasn't. John was his only pediatric patient ever. You know, that was unprecedented. And it's only because of Brian that we got to see John, the little boy, I mean, John lived for 3.5 years. But, yeah. You know, the last 2 years actually 3 years almost were much less nightmarish because of Dr. Druker's drug. And for a year there, it was fabulous. It was just fabulous. And most patients on the drug enjoy that fabulous year that we saw permanently. And there's tens and tens of thousands of patients on Gleevec now.
That's amazing. That really is amazing.
And they're making, you know, they've made several, many billion dollars in net profit on this drug, I might add. The drug company, Novartis, it just went off patent. So now there's an Indian company that does a generic version of the drug. But any event, it's a gigantic story, and nobody knows the John part of it, except Brian Druker knows it, and a couple of people at Novartis know it. I'm not in touch with anybody, except you know, once a year, maybe twice a year, with Dr. Druker. But nobody really knows the story, and I don't. It's probably there's so many elements to it that are that might need to wait and still another few years. So I don't know what all my book is gonna say, but that's the guts of the Drucker part of the story. What else do I have to tell you about the FDA? Well, the second drug, I'll jump ahead because this is instructive. Again, for people who need, and I think, for example, and there was a mother, for example, who she had 5 or 6 kids. She wrote a piece in the journal a couple of years after my first one in 2002 ran. And she needed a drug for a cancer, and the FDA wouldn't let her take, you know. And it was not as dramatic as Gleevec, but it was clearly a giant advance. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there who need to know how to deal with protocol-driven drug companies and, to some extent, protocol-driven oncologists and the FDA.
So what else do we need to hit on this that finishes it up and that tells people the stuff that you want to make sure they know after you've gone through this?
Well, the third element is John reaccelerated the second experimental drug, which we took in combination with Gleevec, didn't really do the job, and it acted like a chemo, so it really it killed a lot of good cells, and in the end he contracted pneumonia, and we had to watch him die over 6 weeks.
Oh my.
So, the FDA part of that story is that what the drug companies do, and the bigger they are, the more they do it, is when they have to, they hide behind the FDA, and they'll throw you off, they'll stiff arm you when you contact them, by blaming the FDA for, in effect, they anticipate FDA rejection, so they say we can't do it, or they'll say that the FDA is making us file a protocol. One of the funniest things I heard from one of the drug companies is, well, I wanted the experimental drug, the second one. Well, we don't have a protocol for this drug. They would say deadpan. Well, of course they don't have a protocol for the drug. And by definition, a protocol is a tested formula. But they would do that, and always the FDA was an element to that. But when I went down to Washington with John, and I won't use a name, but again, it was a very big name in politics, and staff member assigned to the medical detail in that office said, "Ma'am, no, I think we can do this. We deal with them all the time, you know." And by the way, this was an opposite political party. So again, I have to say that this office was not looking for a donation. They weren't going to get one out of me. They did it, you know, because this was one of their good days. Let's put it that way. But I just found it very interesting that if you're on the right committee or subcommittee, you can get your phone calls answered more easily.
You know, there's something, you know, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. There's something weirdly Soviet about the whole procedure.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Oh,
you know?
Well, you know.
But I mean, like, in other words, everybody involved knows that the requirements are unreasonable. Like, everybody, the people everybody knows they're unreasonable. And so, therefore, nobody is saying to you, well, you know, sir, it would be dangerous if we went ahead. They all know it's just stupid. It's just a stupid bureaucratic regulation. And so, we're going to pick up the phone and get them to override it.
Right. It wasn't that simple, but in one case, it was made to sound that simple to me. I'll say that. But you're right. And I've said this to another reporter that the whole FDA colossus puts me in mind of the Soviet Union in the 1980s, when it was known that nobody in the Soviet Union at the top in the Kremlin was really a communist. You know, I mean, everyone knew this had to collapse, but nobody was willing to make it collapse. It did happen. It did happen. And not to get it political here, but that's what fascinates me a little bit about Trump, because he's the very type who could, you know, find himself in the White House and wipe out the FDA monopoly, or whatever we're going to call it, instantly, you know. Because it's going to take somebody like that to wipe the slate clean. Everybody knows the FDA is a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly everybody who listens to this show knows it. And I think, you know, when average people have an encounter with it, other than what they read about in the newspaper, that it's just there to help us out, they join our ranks on this issue. Let's finish up with, you know, you're talking to people who, there could be people in my audience who know somebody with cancer, they're suffering with it now, they, heaven forbid, know a child with cancer, or that, you know, anybody could potentially get, you know, be diagnosed with cancer at some point. What do they need to know, and what is it that, you know, that you didn't know before, but that you now know because of your experience?
The single most important thing is to read as much as you can about the disease that you have, and to be skeptical of the protocol that the oncologist or hematologist almost certainly is using on you or your son or daughter or parent. You've got to read. You got to go find. There are studies that will tell you the truth about the drug. The truth about your chances, and now you can find clinical trials that of newer drugs that very often, even if they don't kill the cancer, might be much less damaging to your system. So you've got to be skeptical and you've got to read. Otherwise, give up, man, and go ahead and get, you know. And most people do. Most people just do what they're told. They find a reason to like their oncologist. I've been through that psychology with the first four that we dealt with, you know, every day practically with John. And that's just a loser. That's just a loser psychology. Because these folks, you know, as I said, like everyone in every profession, you've got good ones and you've got average ones and you've got poor ones. And it's disturbing to have seen so many poor and average hematologists and oncologists out there. Very disturbing. But it took me at least 10 months to get up to speed on that and to even be able to judge, because the first 6 or 7 months, I really didn't read as much as I should have. And I trusted these folks. Now, I also will say that in the Northeast, I found the most arrogance, the most rudeness, and that can really impact your care. It's not just rudeness. It can, if you're not able to talk to your doctor, especially when you're taking care of somebody with cancer, you're not going to get the best information, and somebody's going to suffer as a result. More often than not, somebody's going to suffer what they didn't have to suffer. So you just have to do that. And by the way, anyone who wants to talk to me, they can send me an email. I give them my email address, and they can shoot me a note. I will respond, and quickly.
Well, here's what I'll say, because I don't want to put your email address out there because heaven knows what will happen. But if people contact me, I'll forward it to you. So contact me, not through email. Contact me through the website, through tomwoods.com on the contact page, and I will send that right over to Roger.
Yeah, my pleasure, really. Anyway, in evaluating doctors, you first of all, you have to evaluate them. I don't care where they are. We had one at a major place, put it that way, and she actually attempted to stop our use of this drug in a very direct way, and she had no business doing it, but she did, and we found out about it, and we had to fire them. So you cannot put total trust in any physician until they've earned it. You know, and then by all means, trust them, because in the end, you're in God's hands more than anyone's. And all you can do is evaluate and make the best of your situation. But by all means, do that. Don't assume anything just because they're at a good place or they have a good record. I mean, God knows how many surgeries, for example, have been done needlessly by good guys at good places. That's or how many lousy economists come from Harvard to switch image a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So it shouldn't be so hard for people to accept this idea. We see it all the time.
Yep. And yet, you know that when you're vulnerable is when this psychology kicks in, where you absolutely want to trust the one in whose hands your life.
Yeah, sure.
So it's not that I advocate an ignorant and crude approach to, you know, all docs and all medicine. I believe in synthetic drugs. You know, I've seen what they can do. Gleevec itself comes from the soil in Africa. Ultimately, that's where the molecule was found that is now Gleevec. So you have to synthesize and mass produce a lot of these drugs. So I'm not that type at all. And I don't believe dried blueberries are going to kill your lung cancer. They might help, okay. But you're going to need something, and you're going to need the profession. But you have to evaluate them, and you cannot do too much reading. And read the footnotes, too. So, I mean, I have so much to say, and it's probably bore the average listener, but anyone who needs a specific question answered, I'll try to answer it via your, through you, Tom.
Yeah, definitely. Write to me.
I'll personally answer them. No problem.
Well, Roger, all I can say is, I mean, I know you already know this, but go ahead and write that book, Write that book.
It's coming. It's a year away, and I'll call you when it's ready.
Yeah, exactly. Just do that, because we'll bring you back on. We'll talk some more. I don't know how to thank you for this particular conversation, other than to say we're all grateful, and I have a feeling you will hear from some people. And thanks a lot for today.
Thanks, Tom. Much obliged. It's the first time I've done any kind of public discussion of it.
That's really amazing. Well, I'm glad to have been the conduit for that. Thanks again. All right. Before I let you go, I want to read you one little thing. Roger wrote to me after this and said that, of course, any doctor listening to this would wonder why toward the end didn't they at least try a second transplant? Well, what have you got to lose? And he wanted to add that that was their intent. He wrote, "A month before he died, we agreed with Drucker's idea, which itself was revolutionary in the field, to do what Brian called a micro transplant. He was very concerned that John could not long survive without something to augment Gleevec. Gleevec was still killing John's primary leukemic cells, but in CML patients like John, there is mutation into a second primitive white blood cell that Gleevec is powerless to stop. Drucker reasoned that because we did not wish to put John through a mini transplant, still less a regular bone marrow transplant, both of which would have meant that John would suffer greatly and be taken off Gleevec, we would find a much gentler transplant acceptable, hence microtransplant. Part of the insane transplant procedure was total body irradiation, where John would have been placed on a gurney and dosed over 5 days with the same amount of radiation as in Hiroshima. Brian's concept was dramatically less radiation. Time ran out on us because John worsened rapidly, but we had begun preparing to do the microtransplant Dr. Drucker urged upon us." All right, that's it for today. Ryan Daniel Moran joins us tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.